has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they
actually
spotted both sides, but
I'm sorry,
like
I
say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. All right, Lisa, are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
What a thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Most peculiar, Mama. Roll.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
This is edition 407 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced. UFOs, unidentified flying objects. It's good you could join us, whether you be here in Toronto, whether you're in Montreal, whether you're listening around the world on the web or via the podcast. Glad that you could join us. An interesting program tonight. Tonight, Dave Ferlot with his take on it. An old mystery that happened over Lake Superior in the 1950s resurfaces. We'll talk to UFOBC's Gord Heath about that. And taking us home tonight, as he does every 2 weeks, Alfred Lemberg. Interesting things going on in the world of ufology. Chris Rutkowski, he of the Canadian UFO Survey, and he's also Canada's official receiver of government department reported UFOs, got a phone call from a radio station in Newfoundland yesterday about a sighting in Brent's Cove on the north shore of the island. He told the Canufo email list yesterday that the sighting occurred at around 11:25 Newfoundland time, or Newfoundland time, last Saturday night, August 19th. Actually, while we were on air, this went down. A man and a woman were out enjoying the night air on their porch when the sky lit up, they said, and they saw a huge V-shaped object hanging motionless in the air. It had at least 50 small lights, according to the witness, outlining its form, and both witnesses had time to get a good look at it before the lights went out. However, they said the sky was bright enough that they could still see the outline of the object. And Chris Rutkowski suggests in parenthesis, would it possibly be after image in the retina? Well, they continued to watch the night sky and ponder what they'd seen, and at around 11:45 p.m., the lights turned on again, to quote the witnesses, and the object was still in the same location hanging over the cove. After a few minutes, the object rotated to point south and then moved off, and then its lights extinguished for the last time. The witness drew a sketch of what he'd seen for others in town and learned that many had seen it as well. Then he was shown a photo of the Phoenix lights and was shocked to see that it appeared identical to his sketch. He'd never heard of the Phoenix lights before and was not interested in UFOs, I guess until he had that sighting. Chris Rutkowski says that this information came from an interview with the witness broadcast on CBC Radio. The witness has a very significant accent, and it was hard to make out some of his comments by. But he seemed like a good, straightforward witness. And in Saskatoon, for the past few weeks, there have been a dramatic increase in UFOs, daylight white spheres, west of Rostherne in Saskatchewan, which is a yearly happening at this time of year and seems to be related to crop circle season, which is getting underway. When these spherical UFOs show up in the daylight skies, they have a tendency to sit motionless for some time before either disappearing on the spot or slowly traveling across the sky until they're out of sight. Witness says they went camping on a beautiful clear night on a hilltop, and five witnesses sat in chairs to begin what the reporting witness hoped would be an interesting night of sky watching. So he turned his flashlight on and off very quickly when a star sitting motionless began to move slowly to the right. He again flashed his light, but this time he was almost in disbelief as he observed it flash back instantly with a brief but very strong white light. Ooh! Oh, that would set the hairs on the back of my neck curling. They watched this object move much more slowly than any satellite as it made a right slight turn, and he then flashed his light at it twice, and it sent back two immediate flashes, with a second one being much brighter and intense. At that point, I would grab my chair and run. The object sped up, and about 30 seconds later, he gave it a quick single flash, and it immediately sent a flash back that was much brighter than any other previous flash. After the last flash it gave them, it just went a short distance, and then it disappeared. The rest of the night was uneventful. Yeah, apart from chattering teeth and knocking knees, huh? It was using very basic communication. That's from Dennis via HBCC UFO and Brian Vike. Well, these are strange days, ain't they, though? They're just things that are going on out there that are just beyond the ken of you and I. And despite official denials, all of that stuff still goes on. Yeah, there aren't any souvenir ashtrays or coasters, but the preponderance of evidence is just absolutely mind-boggling. And if it boggles my brain, then the really well-educated, scientifically inquiring minds should also be boggled, but apparently they're not. And neither are the government's minds boggled, neither are representatives at all levels of government. And really, it's only us aluminum foil-wearing loonies who find all of this fascinating. Or is it? Are you secretly listening out there, you who can actually do something about it and are too chicken to? Strange days.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berloff.
So this past Thursday, a bunch of prominent astronomers gathered together in Prague, Czech Republic, and decided to demote Pluto. No, not Mickey Mouse's dog. I don't think you can get demoted lower than having a mouse as your master, even if he is the famous Mickey. The demotion was for that little planet. Okay, not a planet any longer. Rock? Wait a sec. Lesser planetary body? Or dwarf planet? Or minor planet is the correct term now. Orbiting the sun that we affectionately named Pluto back in 1930. Now, normally this isn't a big thing. Most people I know aren't even aware of it, but what bothers me about it is a bunch of men and women whose only occupation is looking at the stars got together and had a trial without even consulting the defendant. From what I gather, they started out this kangaroo court by initially proposing to reaffirm Pluto's status as a planet along with its three moons. And obviously somebody stood up at one point and said, you know, hey, I think it should not be a planet. Now, if you want the truth, I think they were beginning to run out of things to talk about at the conference where 2,500 of them were attending. And what about the poor defendant? Nobody went out to arrest him. Nobody served him papers. Nobody even allowed him to be present during his trial. The scientists, astronomers actually, got together and decided the fate of Pluto without consulting him in any way, shape, or form. Not only that, but they passed sentence by proclamation. Now, Think about this for a second. In the last 5 years, we have learned more about Mars than we did in the past 150. Now, this means that we've been actively looking at the planet Mars on a global scale, while poor little Pluto has been only theorized about, it's looked at incessantly, and although we know very little about it, a bunch of scientists on some other planet pass judgment simply by proclaiming that it's no longer a planet. Did they consult anyone? Did they bother holding a planetary referendum so you and I could get a choice? Nope. They had a few drinks, talked, had some more drinks, talked some more, and then somebody stood up and said, okay, it's agreed, Pluto is not a planet anymore, call the press. So what does this mean? The other planets are probably laughing and calling poor Pluto names now, and someday we might look up in the sky only to find that Pluto couldn't take the humiliation, packed up his moons and leaves for another solar system that will appreciate him. In the grand scheme of things, it really means very little. Firstly, you have to realize that this proclamation comes from a group that contains a very prominent astronomer who once proclaimed that there are no such things as UFOs because he's never seen any. Now, does this proclamation have any impact on you or me? Nah. I personally think that Pluto is a planet because it circles our sun and it has three moons that circle it. I'm not going to refer to Pluto as a dwarf planet or a minor planet. I'm going to call it the planet Pluto. And here's the part that should really frost the astronomers at their little conference. Pluto doesn't care what you call him. Pluto is going to continue circling the sun long after these astronomers are gone from this planet. Whether we call him a planet, a dwarf planet, or a little ball of mud floating in space, he really doesn't care. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Dave, indeed.
And as has been said many times in much of the media the last couple of days, the mnemonic for remembering the planets is all messed up now.
Oh, yeah, it's history.
Yeah, what are the kids going to do?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of that sort of decision-making sounds cavalier.
Extremely cavalier, especially when you consider, like I said, at the beginning they were saying, okay, we're going to reaffirm Pluto's status.
Mm-hmm.
Hello? What happened?
Yeah, I find it remarkably similar to the attitude of science and particularly astronomers to UFOs.
Well, as far as they're concerned about UFOs, like I said, I haven't seen any UFOs. They don't exist.
How does that happen?
The thing is, they keep talking about the astronomers are very important to this planet. They're only looking at about 3% of our entire sky at any given time. Hello?
Dave Furlong, thank you, sir. Good night, Dave.
Good night.
Good night. Good take. Gord Heath is with UFO British Columbia. He lives out on the left coast there. He's the Canadian investigator of the Kinross case, which happened in November 1953. The last time Gord was on, I believe we talked about this very case, but since it has been such a long time and there are so many new listeners to the program and people newly interested in UFOs, and Gordon can fill us in on what transpired on that fateful day for a couple of United States Air Force officers. Good evening, Gord Heath.
Good evening, Errol, and good evening to all your listeners.
Let's get into this event that happened out over Lake Superior back in November 1953.
Yeah, so it starts off getting into late afternoon. There's an Air Force base located just a few miles south of Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Base is called Kinross Air Force Base. At that time, all the Air Force squadrons who were regularly there were away, and they had a detachment up there on temporary assignment from another Air Force base in Madison, Wisconsin. So they were the ones who were in the alert hangars when this came in. There's different versions as to what actually caused the alert. The classic one, as far as UFO encounter part of it, was an indication that there was an unidentified return that showed up on radar over Sioux Locks in restricted airspace. supposedly caused him to call the alert. Now, if you read in the actual official report, they said it was a Canadian Air Force plane that was flying 30 miles off of its course on the other side of the lake, flying over the lake in an eastward direction. The F-89 did go out over the lake on an air defense mission. So it flies out. It's gone for about 15, 20 minutes. They had some problems with radio communications, so they had to switch back and forth from different channels. As they got closer, they made a couple of course corrections. Their last radio contact was when the F-89 was about 10 miles away from the unidentified return. And from that point, they were still giving directions to it over radio, and they observed it still in pursuit of the unidentified return. In the last minutes, all they see is return from the F-89 merges with the return from the unidentified that they're out to check. They expected them to separate again because they're coming in on slightly different courses. It shouldn't stay with it. The return from the F-89 just never shows up again. It also has what's called an IFF signal, which is an identification code that comes with the airplane telling the radar controllers which craft it is. That disappears also.
IFF, the identification friend or foe signal. Back in 1953, they had those IDs just the way aircraft do now.
It was a very much more primitive form of it, I'm sure.
Would the actual ID show up on the screen the way it does nowadays?
They may have just had the radar information up. They may have had other ways of getting that information. It's not just the position they're tracking with radar. They also have altitude tracking, which is needed if you're doing an intercept.
What sort of altitude are we talking about here?
It was about 7,000 or 8,000 feet. When they were flying out over the lake, they sent them up as high as 30,000, which is more efficient for flying, I guess. And then in the last 5 minutes of the pursuit, they go down to 7,000 or 8,000 feet, the altitude at which the unidentified was known to be at.
For the sake of our overseas listeners, we should point out that Lake Superior is like a really big honking inland sea.
It's the largest in area. It's the largest in area lake in the world.
Lake
it is
Superior,
phenomenally,
yeah.
Because it is like an inland sea, mm-hmm. I refer to it as. If you look at it, where the disappearance took place, it is, you know, a center of the lake, far away from the shoreline. That's where this encounter took place.
It took him, what, 20 minutes to get out there?
Yes.
20
minutes?
It was
about 170 miles northwest of Kinross Base at that point.
Which is on the shore of Lake Superior. You're saying
like,
it's 170 miles to the center of the lake.
It's actually 40 miles to the closest shoreline, which would be the tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula from Michigan that kind of juts out into the middle of the lake.
Felix Moncla was the pilot?
Lieutenant Felix Eugene Moncla, Jr. He actually went by the name Gene. And his radar operator was Robert L. Wilson, Lieutenant Robert Wilson.
So these guys fly out over the lake for 20 minutes. They're at 30,000 feet. There's this unidentifiable radar return. It's not saying I'm such and such or I'm
right.
so and so.
Yeah, their whole purpose is to go out there and to identify it.
The United States Air Force officially said that the UFO was a Royal Canadian Air Force, what, a Dakota C-47?
That's right.
Well, wouldn't the Royal Canadian Air Force Dakota C-47 also have an IFF on board?
I'm not sure as to whether it did or not, but in the official report, they say that they believe the target was this C-47 and that it was just off course. However, the pilot of this plane, who I located relatively recently, has indicated to me that there's no possibility that he was ever flying off course.
It's parachute test dummy time, isn't it, with the United States Air Force?
A big mogul
balloon. So the Royal Canadian Air Force Dakota is on course and headed out over the lake also. Do we know how far away from the unidentified the Canadian Air Force twin prop was?
Well, it's hard to say, but what I've been able to get from the pilot, Jerry Fosberg, what his description of the route that night was an indication they went pretty much straight from Fort William, or what is present-day Thunder Bay, to Sault Ste. Marie as waypoints on their course that night, which was taking them from Winnipeg en route back to their base near Ottawa. The key part about this is that the intercept actually takes place quite some distance north of that
line of flight. Yeah. So how far away from the Canadian Air Force Dakota was this unidentified and the United States Air Force jet fighter?
Well, we don't know exactly because we don't know whereabouts on its route it was at that night, other than the fact that its route was at least 30 miles to the south of the place where the F-89 disappeared, at least 20 miles over into Canadian airspace. They did contact the pilot about it. They just asked him if they had seen the F-89, and he reported he had not. He was totally unaware of the whole thing.
Of course. I mean, why would he?
Yeah.
he's not on the same channel as the Americans. Don Ledger had wondered if it were possible that some sort of gas rising from the bed of Lake Superior had enveloped the F-89. Gas in an engine would snuff the engine out immediately. There would be literally no oxygen, and the plane would plummet out of the sky. And Don mused or wondered if it were possible that the blip that was the unidentified on the radar might have been a cloud of gas from the bottom of Lake Superior.
Well, I can't imagine getting a rather well-defined blip from a cloud of gas. Certainly it's possible to postulate all kinds of theories as to what might have caused the plane to drop out of the sky. The point is, the two blips merged. There was never any tracking of the F-89 descending below 7,000 feet. It disappeared. So, I mean, as far as the radar capabilities and whatever at that time, but all we know is that it was tracked by at least three or four radar sites on the U.S. side. I've heard it also was tracked on the Canadian side. So it wasn't just the possibility of one radar malfunctioning or something. There's a lot to this mystery that somewhat defies all kinds of explanations. I myself don't believe that is likely what caused it.
Although that explanation has been used explaining some of the events in the Bermuda Triangle where ships disappeared off the surface, aircraft completely disappeared.
Even there, it's a theory. We don't really know yet. We know that there is such things in the Bermuda Triangle. We don't know to what degree these will happen at once, how much of a gas release you get at once, and whether in practical terms, whether it can cause it. In theoretical terms, it certainly can if there's enough of a gas release. Certainly in terms of sinking a ship, and also they've shown the possibility that that can cause an engine to kick out, of course. But beyond that, it's to me just another side theory on this case that doesn't really address the key questions that well.
And to bring this story up to date now, there was an interesting press release that was posted by Francis Ridge, who runs the Current Encounters email list. He got hold of a copy of a press release out of Port Huron, Michigan, which reads in part, "A group of Michigan divers operating a next-generation sophisticated side-scan sonar have answered, they claim, one of the Great Lakes' enduring mysteries and may have uncovered another." It talks about the U.S. Air Force F-89 Scorpion fighter jet that we've been talking about, which disappeared over Lake Superior while trying to intercept and investigate an unusual radar blip. The wreckage of the plane and bodies of the two crew members had never been found. What's interesting about this is that using this fairly sophisticated side-scanning radar, they have made images of an aircraft on the bottom of Lake Superior, and are suggesting perhaps that it might be this F-89 Scorpion jet fighter.
Actually, I've reviewed their information. Initially, when I heard about it, I was skeptical. When I first saw the images, I was a little bit skeptical, but I started to look into it more. And I've also been in touch by email with them. And I definitely see that there's a very high possibility that this is exactly as it's being reported. Is the discovery of the missing F-89, or at least most of the missing F-89.
And side-scan radar, the resolution of the images that it produces, are actually quite startling, but they're not clear enough to be able to definitely identify something.
Right. It's pretty suggestive, you know, in terms of its overall form. And side-scan sonar is used very much these days for this type of purpose. Yeah. They use it all the time for locating shipwrecks, and they get very good images. A lot of people seem to think that the images were too good, but in fact, the technology is very advanced these days, and they are able to get images of this quality. Now, as you say, it still isn't like getting a video image, which is should be the next step in this investigation.
Are they going to put a mini sub or something down there to take a look at it and see if they can read any of the IDs on the aircraft?
I'm certainly hoping it's going to happen. I was talking to members of the family of the pilot I've been in touch with over the last several years, and all of them are hoping that there's going to be further clarification and investigation of this. But in the email that I received from the Great Lakes Dive Company, they did say to me that although the F-89 is most certainly a priority for us, we have already been contacted by the Canadian government, who are seriously opposed to us finishing the ROV work at the site and have also asked for location depth info regarding the wreck.
The wreck is on the Canadian side of the lake.
Oh, yeah. People are always doing investigations of wrecks all over the lake.
Why the Canadian government's concern over this?
Well, I don't know. My suspicion is that they are, just going on my experience with what I've seen on this whole investigation, is that this is just another part of potential cover-up. I have to mention about another occasion where parts were found in 1968 by two prospectors north of Sault Ste. Marie on the coastline, in the bush, but close to the shoreline of Lake Superior. They brought the parts out. They took pictures of it, put in the papers. They had a U.S. Air Force officer saying that was definitely parts from a military jet aircraft, fighter aircraft. And they said it could be any of several. And then this story, after being front page news for 2 days, nothing was followed up. And neither government will provide any sort of indication of what it was that was found.
This is becoming stranger and stranger as you tell the story. Are they actually working for the Canadian government, or are they on a project of their own and the Canadian government is suggesting that they don't do too much down there, whatever that wreckage is on the bottom?
There's many, many organizations that go out and look for wrecks because there are so many of them. This is a group of Michigan divers. There are other projects that they're looking for to old shipwrecks also. The reason they looked for this one is they were aware of the fact it was missing. They knew the final coordinates, the approximate GPS coordinates, where it disappeared. So they had a good take of a start position, and they had a short amount of time to do their testing because of weather conditions when they first went out there. This was back last year when they actually did the discovery actually occurred. And they've done since then gone back and done about 28 different scans. They've actually done quite a bit of work on this site. They've tried to locate what is missing from the plane, which is the port wing and the starboard side of the tail horizontal stabilizer. Both seem to be just rather very cleanly cut off from the plane and missing from the site.
Yeah, it seems to be laying on its left side.
I look at the starboard wing, the right wing, the one that's clearly visible. The other one is not there, and you can see it's broken off. You can see that the nose and the tip of the one wing seem to be dug into the sediment. The rest of it seems to be relatively sitting on it, although a little bit of an angle. The tail is right up above the surface. It was named F-89 Scorpion because of the way the tail was raised. And you can see that very clearly in the image. But if you look at turn 90 degrees clockwise, you can see sort of the shape of the wing and the acoustic shadow that side-scan sonar has cast on.
And it does look like the red aircraft in your report at ufobc.ca. It looks somewhat similar.
This very much looks like an F-89, like the shape of the fuselage, the shape of the wing. There's certain details you can't see that well, which is that they say that the canopy is in place, or the canopy's there. So and it's hard for me to see what I'm looking at as far as canopy.
Yeah, I think it looks more obvious in the second image, where you're looking at it overhead.
Well, it looks like there's maybe that one little fish-shaped part of the canopy because it tapers off at the back. Anyone who's listening who has access to the internet would turn there and see those images.
Yes.
Very, anyone who's acquainted with the F-89, I talked to my brother who's a pilot, and he said, well, F-89, he had a couple of comments that he made about the length of the wing, but he wasn't sure. He said it looked to him like an F-89, and certainly most of the people I've talked to believe that it is. They're looking at, and perhaps they see it a little bit differently or seeing certain details differently. It's a matter of interpretation and also the quality of the raw image. It's because you got a lot of scattered little dots, which is mostly what you're getting back from the seabed itself, right in that area.
I encourage listeners to go look for yourselves via tonight's program listings in the news and information section, and you can read the press release, and then you can go to this Great Lakes Dive Company and take a look. Images aren't copyable. It's all done as flash. Interesting nonetheless. It'll be good at some point in the not-too-distant future when these guys get back ashore to get a hold of them and have them on the program and maybe have you back, Gord.
Well, I'm certainly hoping to talk to them when they're back off of their boat. I'm hoping very much that they are going to get some video of this because it's something that's absolutely needed for us, the general public. The government doesn't seem to have an awful lot of interest in UFOs, but for some reason they seem to have a lot of interest in keeping the information away from us.
What we don't know won't hurt us, they hope.
Yes.
We got to cut it short here, Gord, unfortunately, but it has been good and always interesting when new things pop up about old stories. I mean, we're talking about a 53-year-old story. Yeah.
Story, and in fact, this is obviously the biggest break in that 53 years. Thank you very much for having me, Errol.
Thank you for being there on this interesting breaking news in the world of ufology. Good night, Gord Heath.
Good night to you.
UFOBC.ca, or you can get to the report that Gord Heath wrote via tonight's program listing. Lots of stuff to do with Sky this week. The Jerry Hamm video that's up there on YouTube, Alfred Lemberg's piece that is also out there, Sky Lights, the title of that one. Alfred Lemberg joins us. Good evening. An interesting couple of weeks since last you were on here, Alfred Lemberg.
Yeah, true, true, true. I want to talk about Gordon Heath. His Kinross research, and I'm correct that the year that all of this occurred was 1953, right?
That's right, November 23rd.
November 23rd. So, like, wasn't it September in, I think it was it 52 or 53 on the Flatwood Monsters affair?
It was around that time, too, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, see, that's the point. That's the point. And you come to discover that there are a lot of different occurrences in that time frame and around that point, and a veritable flap of UFOs that is really kind of undersold, and that things like military aircraft encountering UFOs, especially given a shoot-down order, military and UFOs having untoward interactions with one another, so to speak, is not beyond the pale. We're going to be hearing a lot more on that subject from Frank Fascino when he lets his book here go real shortly.
We talked about that with both Frank and Stan Friedman a little while back on the program.
Yeah.
UFO shootdowns.
And again, the point that I wanted to make is pointing right back at Gordon Heath saying that, okay, you know, Mr. Heath, I think we're going to have to give you the nod here that you may be on the right track and that we should be paying a little more attention to you.
I find it interesting that, again, that thing about cover-ups looms its head.
Even the word, and I kind of winced when I heard it because I could feel the listening audience at the phrase kind of clam up and go, okay, yeah, they're talking about cover-ups again. You judge a tree by its fruit, and if the fruit around you that you can see is cover-up, you've got to give the devil his due. Jeez.
I want to read you an email, which I thought was kind of interesting. This is from Monsieur Peltier. His first one, I recently obtained this book through the internet and have read it, The Threat. Certainly the ET Mafia is doing hybridization and plans an integration and takeover, but there are areas of uncertainty we can only speculate about. There are two things which seem to point to extermination as part of the plan. This is the David Jacobs book. Have you read that, Alfred?
Yes.
Good.
Twice, actually.
So perhaps you can respond to this. Something horrible catastrophic is going to happen, says Alison Reed on page 240 of the threat. And Reshma Kamal was told Earthlings will be kept as a small breeding population on page 253 of the threat. This is, like I say, only speculation, but they would be able to do it. And it is along the lines of what Dave Frelott has suggested. And also the ET Mafia shows signs of psychopathy, is that the way that's pronounced? And
psychopathy.
And is similar to a certain political party of the 30s and 40s Germany. Whatever the case, the only real hope we have is in an intervention by benign ETs. So that's Bernard Peltier's observation on the threat.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, all I can say in response is different strokes for different folks. And different people have an entirely contrary or at least 90 degrees out with a twist view on things. And not the least of these was the late Dr. Mack, who had, maybe we could possibly even be elevated in this exchange. You know, maybe we could be expanded in some way. You know, maybe we could be improved in some manner. Six, one half dozen of the other. They're either eating their heads or at the other end of the spectrum, you've got ushering us into the Galactic Brotherhood. Hey, what's really happening is likely a lot weirder than that.
It's what I keep saying. I want to know the answer, but I may not like it. I just want to stick, Alfred, with the abduction thing for a moment. I got a call here from Matt out there in Burlington, Ontario. Good evening, Matt.
Earl, another great show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Bowing deeply in your general direction.
I had a quick question for you. Last week you were talking about the book by Bud Hawkins, and the name escapes me right now. But I was looking for that book, I guess, on their website and on other bookstore websites, and it seems to be out of stock everywhere. And I just wonder if you know if it's being reprinted or if Alfred...
Have you tried Amazon.com or .ca?
Tried Amazon.com, tried... Chapters Indigo, usual, and then I guess there are his own website, and everything just shows out of stock. Or
it seems to me that those books came out, 10, 12, 14 years ago now.
Yeah.
So unless you can pick it up in a used bookstore, I don't know. I haven't talked to Bud in many, many months, and I don't know if there are any plans to reissue. Have you tried your library?
I did, actually, yes. Tried the local library. They don't have that book listed at all, so maybe I'll have to expand the search.
Julian asks if it might be witnessed.
Yeah, it could be.
Really, the only way to find out, Matt, is download last week's program. It's about 7 or 8 megabytes. You'll hear the title in there. Julian says he's got 21 copies of Witnessed by Bud Hopkins on eBay right now.
Okay, there we go.
They've all been taken in the last 30 seconds. Julian bought them all. He said you can have a copy for $55.75.
There we go. That's great.
Sorry, couldn't be more specific, Matt.
No, perfect. I'll check on eBay.
It's good to know you're out there.
Have a good night.
Good night. So, Alfred, now that we've almost used up all of your time again this week.
Oh, matters not. You know, it's all grist for the mill. I want to talk real quickly about Mr. Frelott, and once again, boy, he nailed it with regard to the discussion on Pluto this evening, and the words that are being canted around by suspect institutions with regard to demotions of planets like human beings could pronounce on a planet. And the word I think you guys were looking for was planetesimal. I've heard that used a lot with regard to Pluto.
I thought it was the word excommunicated might have fit there, too.
This discussion about Pluto and rearranging the planets in the solar system, you know, I wonder about an underlying mechanism. You know, what are the sociological, the political, the institutional implications of this strange proclamation from a bunch of strangers that did not contact Mr. Frelott? And something else, too, that I remembered, that Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of Pluto, was one of the legitimate astronomers who have seen a UFO.
UFO.
And he saw a pretty convincing, highly strange... he was convinced it was a UFO. There you have it.
Referring back to email and the very beginning of the program when I happened to mention that, you know, I might be wearing a tinfoil hat. Wendy Connors of Faded Discs, who is going to be on this program very soon,
and is most
happy at the moment, says in her email, "Hi, Errol, I would never be caught dead wearing a tinfoil hat to keep those bug-eyed aliens from getting into my skull. I'm a self-respecting researcher, and my hat is made from copper mesh laminated with 24-karat gold. Thank you."
Right.
I love Wendy Connors.
She has the thieves and scallywags heading her direction now.
Yes. That's that's what we do best on this program. We talk UFOs, the implications, the politics, the ufologists, and no holds barred, nothing sacred.
You know, back cleaning up a few more points on Pluto.
Yes.
I really think that we need to have try to foment a campaign of outrage at not even being remotely consulted on the changes of planets in our solar system.
After generations have spent much time learning the mnemonic. I can never say that word. And I've got 30 seconds to recover, and thank you very much for being with us tonight. Good night, Alfred Lemberg. Wouldn't be you without that. I want to thank Dave Frelott, and of course Gord Heath, Alfred Lemberg, Julian McNabb, driving our station here in Toronto, and at CGAD 800. Well, that's Jim Pacheco. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Dean Mascardelli.